16.
Yeah. And it's an entirely different setting as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now we're in this. We're both in the military institution and her childhood home. So let's talk about the military institution first.
Yes.
What, you know, there's never a time period stated for when this happens. It's all kind of general. So what is the, you know, what is the thinking when designing the whole place?
Well, I mean, this is clearly Casey's past, because, I mean, we get to the point later where we see a 3-year-old Casey asleep. Mm-hmm. So my assumption in this is that it's the mid to late 90s, or maybe not mid to late 90s, just somewhere in the 90s, you know? So my initial thoughts about where this was at first was, you know, it was somewhere in the Middle East, but there's a forest nearby, so that's not true. But yeah, it's that's my conception of the time period, because, you know, it's in the past with Casey's dad and she's younger. So I at least have kind of like a general timeline where I think it's set. Location is, you know, that's still to be determined. I mean, it could be, you know, anywhere, because, I mean, as you see later, it ties into issue 12, which with Hodge's arrival at Morning Glory Academy. So.
Is that something that you knew beforehand, that the two were linked?
No, not at first. It wasn't until I got the script and then I saw the direction from Nick that we were reprinting those 6 pages from issue 12, that I knew that they were connected. Because at first, no, I didn't have a conception. But my general rule of thumb with this issue was to keep it pretty, you know, basic. To look like it could have been a newer base, but at the same time, keep it just run down enough to where, like, it was like, well, maybe it had been there a while.
And is there anything that you kind of used in terms of the setting of the installation? Were there any particular bases that inspired you or anything like that?
It'll sound silly, but I thought about G.I. Joe. All
right.
because I played with G.I. Joe a lot when I was a kid, and you know, I had all these I had all these play sets and tanks and shit, and I was like, well, you know, I remember, you know, some of the bases they had and stuff, and so, you know, I would look up you know, military outpost or whatever on Google just to get some ideas, you know, like the barracks and stuff, buildings that you see when they go outside, like around issue, or not issue, on page 16 and 17. That was something I referenced, the kind of cylindrical, half-cylindrical shapes, because I wouldn't have thought to do that initially unless I had actually looked it up first.
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I like that the little details of this place, like, you know, in that first panel, if you're looking, you see a grate and a camera in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, first I figured, you know, they can't be cruel. They got to at least have air coming in. And then the other was, you know, they're gonna, you know, they have the two-sided mirror for one, but, you know, if you're, you know, they're gonna have a camera too, so that's why that's there.
Mm-hmm. And this is also the return of Brandon and David.
That's right. Yeah, Brandon is getting to be a real bastard in this scene, doing some waterboarding.
So, you know, why Brandon? What? What about Brandon says to you, someone that would waterboard somebody?
Maybe it's the haircut? No, I don't know. No, well, you know, it just came down to the fact that, you know, we were back at that military base that Casey was captured at, and, you know, I felt bad that Brandon and David only had the one panel kind of cameo, and I was like, well, I'll make them be these guys, because they have some pretty important scenes, and they just happen to be torture scenes. So, I mean, I'm sure made Brandon a lot more vicious and mean than he is in real life, but that's what the character needed.
Well, in the various cameos that those two have done, they're always doing something bad. They're true. They're in Chew, and they run over a character, and David was in a strip of Emmytown where he was, he gave her some bad news accidentally. So I think they're just sort of slated to be those bad guys.
That's awesome.
And then there's, you know, friendly old me, who is a teacher.
Yeah.
And in another comic, a police officer, but that's besides the point. So one thing I kind of want to ask about, you know, we talked about the rain previously, but, you know, illustrating Liquid, and specifically when he, you know, dumps the bucket of water on her, you know, what are you trying to, or what are you using to help, you know, I can't imagine drawing moving Liquid is a very easy task.
It is not easy, and it's another thing that tripped me up a few times. I ended up leaving it as a separate separate layer in Photoshop, making a copy of it after I inked it, and making the water, the flowing water, its own layer in Photoshop. So that way, Alex could take it when he colors it and use an effect called color holds, which is to take the lines and make the lines overlaid with a color that reflects the whatever it is you're coloring. So that, I don't know, that seemed to be more sensible to me than to just try and get the water done like all on my end, because there's so much you can do with color to pull that off, and I think Alex, you know, he did it.
With the scenes at home, you know, we've kind of touched upon it before, but this, I think, gives a more intimate look at her home life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you see her room both as a young adult and as a kid. Mm-hmm. So when just with speaking with the, you know, 16-year-old Casey, what's the inspiration for her room here? You know, we've got a Foster the People poster in the background and some flowers over the door.
Yeah. Very girly. I'm thinking, well, Casey is tough. I mean, her dad has been teaching her how to box and stuff, you know. But I view her at a teenage age. I view her as being a little bit more girly than, you know, a typical kind of tomboy or whatever. That's why she's got the nice, you know, four poster bed there and all the pillows and the flowers, which. I initially drew to be Morning Glory flowers, but I think they got changed to like more daisy type flowers. So that was supposed to be an Easter egg, but I think I changed my mind at the last minute or something. Mm-hmm. And then like the Foster the People thing was, you know, any teenager, a band they like, they're going to, you know, put posters and stuff up around the room. I mean, I sure as hell did. And, you know, Googling teenager rooms or whatever, you know, that's the same. It holds true today, which is, you know, teenagers will decorate with bands they like. And I realized that Posh of the People as a band weren't really probably around at the point of this story when it takes place. But, you know, it was what I was listening to during drawing this issue. And they were just – they're just new – I mean, they're just new enough or old enough, whatever, that I thought that I could get away with it. So that's why they're in the issue.
I think – you know, that poster to me meant that now I had to analyze when this story is taking place.
Yeah.
Since,
yeah.
You know, I asked Nick about, you know, it says a different time. It doesn't say like 2010. And,
yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, I did, and there's another thing at the end of the issue that I did to kind of sort of give an allusion to when the book takes place, too, which, you know, we'll talk about.
We'll talk about that soon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, something I was kind of wondering about, and I'm sure that the answer is probably like Photoshop layers.
Mm-hmm.
The reflections in the in the one-way mirror for
Those are Photoshop layers. It's that way I can drop the opacity of it. And I like if I did that traditionally, I'd have to go super super light with an ink pen or just do it in pencil. And if I do the reflections digitally, then all I got to do is I can draw them at full opacity, and then I can just dial it down so it looks like it's, you know, clouded or whatever. And it's a pretty easy, pretty quick and easy technique.
When is that one of the harder things to, like, illustrate visually?
Yeah.
You know, when matching the faces.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. Like, making sure that it's believable to sync the way, you know, like, that would reflect where they are. And actually, I mean, I don't think I'm 100% great at it, but I think I can do it effectively. But I'm still at the point where it's just like, it's really, you know, you lay it out like basically they're in the same position, but you know, when you have the camera from behind the guy and then you're showing the reflection facing you, it's like, you know, it's two different drawing approaches right there.
Mm-hmm. How often do you use yourself for that reference?
Oh, you know, stuff like that. That's definitely myself as a reference, because it's easier to just use a reference of myself and then constantly playing the guessing game with that. Because it's, you know, and especially with the schedule we have on this book to get it out on time, you know, it's easier to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. So this whole sequence, the torture sequence.
Yeah.
You know, I had Nick speak a little bit about it, but is it, you know, I've found that something like this, torture, is kind of a hot button issue at the moment. So were you at all kind of concerned about how this might be taken? And I, you know, as a caveat to that, I think part of the thing about Morning Glories in general is that when we see violence at the school, we kind of take it at face value because the school is a weird, crazy place. And whenever we see violence outside of the school, it's all almost always more horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a little bit more slasher movie type violence at the school, you know? This is definitely more real world and definitely a hot button issue, as you said. It's, you know, when I got the script, Nick, his thing was, sorry, you get to draw torture.
Mm-hmm.
I really wasn't that bothered by it. It didn't. I mean, I hated having to look up the reference for it, but you know, it wasn't a big deal. I don't know. I think if it serves the story, I don't really have a problem with it. I think, you know, I think, it's a brutal thing to do, and I was like, man, poor Casey. I mean, she really got run through the ringer with that, and. It's a pretty horrible thing to do to your character, but you know, it needed to be done for the story, which is pretty much exactly the same response I'm going to say to something that happens in issue 19.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Casey gets tortured back in issue 2.
Yeah.
You're just kind of like, okay, the school is weird.
Yeah.
But, you know, things that happen outside of the school always seem to have much more grave of a context for whatever reason.
Right.
So, you know, this issue brings back her parents to the front and center. And, you know, those are characters that we didn't really get to spend a lot of time with before they also died in the same issue they appeared in.
Yeah, exactly.
Are these two characters ones that you were, you know, looking forward to returning to, ones that you enjoyed returning to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like drawing Casey's parents. I felt we didn't get enough time with them. Because, I mean, one of the things that I regret about issue 1 was the revelation that her parents were killed at the end of the issue. Well, some people weren't sure those were her parents. They thought they might have been students. And I feel like I didn't get a chance to refine her parents enough to make them effectively look like that's her parents. It's not students. So this was kind of like my opportunity to kind of rectify that a little bit. And, you know, her dad I based on a young Robert Redford. That's who I kind of view him as. Because to me, Robert Redford is sort of like the perennial kind of all-American heroic look. I don't know. He has like that good-natured look to him. But he also looks like he could kick your ass, too. Mm-hmm. At least the younger one. Maybe not the older one. The older one, I think I could kick his ass. But, but you know, then like her mom isn't really basic. I mean, what I'm trying to do with her parents is sort of, you know, kind of come up with where Casey came from. Like sort of do, you know, because when you see certain people's kids, like you know that, okay, that's their kid or whatever. I mean, like Patera gets me on this all the time with my son. He's like, the dude is your clone. So, you know, it's not having them match Casey exactly. Like, I didn't want her mom to be an older Casey, but I did want them to look like they could be her parents.
Right.
Yeah.
With the, you know, there's a lot of soldiers in here in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
so I suppose it's good to mention this now. But the soldiers, outside of Brandon and David, how many of them are cameo soldiers? I think Mike appears in the issue, right?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't get his likeness because I don't think I had a picture of him. But I did put his name on one of the name tags of the soldiers. But yeah, no, none of the other soldiers are like likenesses of anybody. But I did try to put in, names of people that I knew. There's a guy named Moss, who's one of the soldiers, and that was the last name of one of my best friends. And then I think there's one. I think there might be one named Burns, which is the last name of the first writer I worked with in comics, Jason Burns. So that's really the extent of it.
So the other cameo thing, the cameo heavy thing, is her childhood bedroom. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few little things in there I remember you telling me about.
Yeah, yeah, that one was that's a fun one. I don't know if I mentioned, but I'm good friends with Charles Paul Wilson III, who draws Stuff of Legend from Third World, which is a great book, and I honestly think Charles is probably the best working artist in comics today, which will crush Nick Patera because he thinks that's him, but... Charles is amazing. You really don't even have to like look any further than just the commissions he posts online to know that that is a fact. But I put his his bear in there on panel 4 from Stuff of Legend because I had just started reading the series when I did this issue, and I don't know. I thought it'd be a fun little cameo, and. Then, yeah, like all the other stuff in her room, the cat that she's holding, the stuffed cat, that's my son's kitty that he carries around, which has seen very better days because that he's had that kitty since he was a baby, and it's battered and beat, and all the stuffing is, like, worn out and everything, but he loves it, so I kind of thought it would be the same thing with Casey, that she would have had a little kitty from when she was a baby, and she still has it. There's the ballerina, actually, Stuff of Legend, in the previous panel, next to the fish tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then my favorite cameo is the happiness bunny there sitting on the toy chest.
Yeah.
from Crayon Shin-Chan, one of my favorite anime / and mangas. It's the most disgusting show sometimes. I mean, I was really surprised. I caught it on Adult Swim a few years ago, and... It was the most vulgar, hilarious cartoon that I had seen sometimes since, like, I think the first time I'd seen South Park. And, this foul-mouthed, disgusting, little five-year-old kid named Shin-Chan. And, one of his friends has this mom that's going through a divorce, and she has this emotional issues, so she takes her daughter's stuffed bunny and just beats the hell out of it. Which is the happiness bunny, so that's why the happiness bunny is in there looking sad, because it's typically always beat up.
That poor bunny. I was gonna mention with the little kitty. Let's be honest. You're baiting the internet a little bit, because everybody likes kitties on the internet.
That's true. Yes, they like kitties, and they like detective kitties. Yeah.
That'll be her future toy.
Yes. You gotta get in the merchandising.
Yeah. we talked a little bit about the various facial expressions that Zoe has in the one issue.
Yeah.
But Casey runs her own level of emotions from rather angry to kind of scared, and Lara does too in a different angle where she's like very flirty and open.
Yeah.
And then she's kind of. She's a bit sinister looking.
Mm-hmm.
Are you basically coming at them from the all the same sort of angles, or do you have different inspirations for them? I know that Lara has her own inspiration that we talked about on the last podcast we did.
Right, right. I did think a little bit of Dirty Dancing for Lara and Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller, actually, the... my favorite panel from this issue. I'm trying to figure out what page it's on. It's the one of Laura in prison, and she's leaning against the wall. It's on page 12. That is totally Jennifer Grey's character from Ferris Bueller. Just that smug smirk on her face. That's exactly what I went to for that, because I don't know. Because Laura, in that particular sequence, she's in control. She's not worried in the least bit. She knows what happens, you know, obviously. And so she's not worried. And I just thought of how smug you know, Jennifer Grey's character in Ferris Bueller was, and applied it there. And with Casey, you know, one thing that really came to mind, like the scene where she's with her dad in the forest, you know, I thought that was a pretty heavy scene, because, I mean, you know, a lot of people gave us grief for that first arc, you know, like Casey's parents died and she didn't break down. She didn't tell anybody. She didn't have that moment. They weren't satisfied with the way she had reacted. And, you know, we talked about this, but how she basically just kept everything bottled up. And then at the end of the issue, she kind of collapsed, or the end of the arc, she collapses into Hunter's arms, you know. But here she is with her dad, who has just died, basically. And, I mean, how would you feel in that situation? I mean, I imagine that it would be like the hardest, you know, the biggest ton of bricks hits her, you know, right there. One particular movie that was really good for that, and this is sacrilege, is that, you know, how could you enjoy that movie? Was the V for Vendetta movie. Natalie Portman, whenever V gets her out of the prison, or the fake prison, and breaks her down, basically, and she just kind of has that moment where she just freaks out. That was it. That was the whole scene with Casey and her dad, was having Casey break down like that, and then trying to compose herself again, because she's a pretty strong, you know, girl in the end.
Mm-hmm. And for Laura and her sinister nature.
Yeah.
Is there any, because, you know, Jen in Dirty Dancing is not the most sinister characters.
No, you know, and it also sounds silly, but, you know, there's a lot of kind of Disney influence here. I think about, like, the villainesses in various Disney movies, just that way they react, you know, like, it's almost kind of cartoonish, kind of the approach that I took to her being sinister, and by the same token, to her being flirty. I just really wanted it to be, you know, overly exaggerated, overly kind of phony in a way. Not to say that she's a phony person, but I think that she's the type of personality that whenever she's like flirty with that guard, that, you know, there's no sincerity to that whatsoever. She's just being extremely manipulative, which up until that point, nobody, you know, had really seen her do, you know?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the reprint area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know you had mentioned in the past, you're not a huge fan of reprints, right?
Right.
But, you know, for this sequence, it certainly changes the perception of you know, the entire event that happened there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love hate them. What I hate is the stigma that I'm too lazy to draw something new, because I've heard that a few times, and I'm like, but it's in the script to reprint those pages. It's not me, but you know, I. And the practical part of me loves having them, because that means less pages that I have to worry about, because they're already done. But, you know, in terms of this issue, yeah, it works. It definitely gives context. And I loved that. I loved the fact that it gave new context to a scene that we had done previously. And so, you know, I was a little concerned with the amount of reprinted pages, because it's like 5 pages or something, I think. And but, you know, in the end, it works. It works for the scene. So, you know, I'm fine with it.
So what do you think happens in these couple pages?
Where are they? Where, the ones from 12?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, you know, there's obviously a journey into very far, far underground. And then a very long distance, because they have to take the cart, you know, the little golf cart type thing. But I mean, the fact that they have to wear radiation suits, I think, is pretty telling. You know, this may not be, you know, the location of the school may not be, you know, exactly a place, a point on a map that you can point to, I don't think. You know, maybe there's something more to it. Because, I mean, obviously, it's a pretty extensive trip to get there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Nick's talked a lot about this, you know, both with us and with other interviews and whatnot, but, you know, there's this heavy time travel aspect to the issue. And I kind of want to get your thoughts on the time travel nature of it all. Like, what really can happen with time travel?
Yeah, I was as mystified about that as anybody. I mean, it's like it definitely creates a loop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my question, which I'm sure we'll get into, is like, you know, where does it diverge? You know, where does where? Because I'm obviously Laura will appear subsequently. So, you know, at what point does she kind of get out of this loop and move on? Because she goes back to 12, and then, you know, if she goes back to where she was in 12, then we have to go all the way back to where she was in 16. So there has to be a diverging point, you know. But my kind of theory, you know, is just that, I mean, obviously, you know, we'll get there, but I mean, that there's something that happens in that point where she goes through that portal or whatever, you know, and then, or at the end of the reprinted pages. So I think there's a lot more to it that, I mean, it's definitely, you know, I think Nick has mentioned this before, but, you know, Casey and Laura's side of the mythology here is definitely more on the sci-fi than the kind of spiritual or supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Now there's something that we didn't really talk about. We kind of skipped over it with the last issue, and I meant to bring it up, but I'll bring it up now. You know, when you're inserting the map into the book, or in this issue, there's a computer screen.
Yeah.
How much of that is you actually going in and, you know, hand illustrating these images, and to what extent are you just, you know, kind of sort of making an image and then shrinking it down and copy pasting sort of into the file on Photoshop?
Yeah. The website, you know, looked at reference for, like, you know, different private schools, like what kind of websites they would have, you know, and they're really kind of academic and elegant looking. So I tried to keep in theme with that. You know, on page 26, when, you know, her dad is looking at the website, you know, I just took a calendar that I found online and shrunk it down. I tried to take off any specific year so you wouldn't know exactly when it was. The logo, we're lucky to have Tim Daniel with us, and he made an Morning Glory Academy insignia. And he made it like an Adobe Illustrator file that we can just bring in whenever we need it. So it's nice that I don't have to just, you know, draw that from hand. I can just grab Tim's file and drop it in. So, you know, all the stuff that's on the screen is all digital. Everything, you know, else was, you know, traditionally inked. So it's a matter of, you know, just cut and pasting for, like, screens and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So the only other major cameo, kind of, sort of, that I know of is the Angela's Ashes copy on the final page here.
I'm sorry, what was that? You cut out for a second.
The only other major, quote-unquote, cameo thing that I know of remaining is Angela's Ashes appearing on the final page.
Yeah, because I looked up what were the best sellers of, like, 1999 or 98, one of those, because I couldn't remember. And Angela's Ashes was at the top of the list for, like, the year or whatever. So just to kind of clue you in, you know, to when this takes place, I put that in there. And, you know, it's funny because people thought that was Joan and Ike behind her. And I'm like, oh, dang it. I wish I – because I at this point, you know, it's the last of the issue. I just kind of – I blanked at that point about likenesses and – and then I'm like, oh, dang it. I look back and I'm like, now I see why people could get confused. Cause, yeah, but those specifically, those two guys aren't anybody. The girl at the counter, though, was based on the ticket girl from Lost. I can't remember her name. I looked her up, but I think she was in one of the earlier seasons, like whenever they were, the Oceanic Six were buying their tickets or whatever. she was the girl working the counter. I just remember her being an Asian girl. So basically, you know, that's my little nod to Lost, because we didn't anything too specific, because I mean, it's just a really generic sign there that says airlines. We didn't want to, you know, tie it to any particular company, because we wanted to make you or show you that this could be any airport anywhere.
Right. So I think the big question on everybody's mind at the end of this issue, all things considered, given that we've got this character that we might not see again, I think everybody kind of wants to know, when are David and Brandon the soldiers coming back?
As soon as we flash back to that time period.
But, you know, this is, more seriously, this is kind of Casey being written out of the book for a bit.
Yeah. No, I was super surprised when I got the script for this. I wrote Nick, I'm like, so we're basically writing Casey out of the book, huh? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, man, that's a big move. Are you sure you want to do this? He's like, yeah. So I was like, okay, well. And every time we have an issue about to come out, any independent creator starts the self-hype machine. And, you know, I've had people tell me, like, you say this about every issue, but I'm like, no, this really is a big issue. And I think people totally underestimated that. But we did. We wrote a character out of the book. And there's no immediate signs of her coming back. So, you know, Casey fans, which, you know, the hierarchy of, like, fans that I hear from the book, you know, are Zoe fans, then Casey fans, you know. So, like, they're like
Dagny
the second
fans.
Yeah, then Dagny fans. And they're like the second majority there, you know. And it's like, you know, your girl's not in our book right now anymore.
Well, all right. Is there anything else major that we missed about the issue?
No. You know, this was, like I said, it was a good opportunity to kind of play around with her parents some more and flesh them out, I think. You know, we got to see them briefly in 13, but, you know, it's... I don't know. I feel much better about them and their depiction after this issue. Maybe we'll see them again. And I think that's about it.